Welcome to the World Bank EdTech Podcast, a conversation on the use of technology and innovation in education globally. My name is Cristobal Cobo. I'm a senior education technology specialist at the World Bank. I'm delighted to welcome you to this new episode where we will explore one of the most influential technologies from 2023, generative artificial intelligence. We will explore how this technology could impact education, but with a special focus on inclusion. We have three excellent guests in today's show. Jamie Alexandre, Learning Equality co-founder and executive director, Paul Afterton, founder and chief executive officer at Fab Inc., and Robert Hawkins, World Bank senior education and technology policy specialist and global lead of technology and innovation in education. To all of you, a very warm welcome. So why don't we dive directly into the conversation? Jamie, welcome to the show. Could you please introduce yourself and give us an overview of Learning Equality's mission and explain how you are currently leveraging AI in education?
Great. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Chris. And wonderful to be here. I have a background in cognitive science. I'm very excited about this conversation because I was working with language models, earlier versions, over 10 years ago. So it's exciting to be able to see and use all of these incredible new developments. But the past 10 years, I haven't primarily been working in that field. At Learning Equality, our focus is on building education technology with a focus on equity. And 10 years ago, seeing that so many of the people in the world were offline, realizing we were going to be leaving out those who might need new opportunities the most. And so our mission really started out with thinking about barriers to equity like connectivity. So we built education technology that can support completely offline environments, whether that's a school, a refugee camp, an orphanage, a home. And we've aggregated this huge library of open educational resources to support different use cases. But one of the big challenges is organizing them to match curricular standards. So that's one of the places where we're now leveraging artificial intelligence. We've been working on for a few years now and now have these prototypes that allows us to bring in new curricular standards, quickly organize content, and then distribute them for use offline by teachers and students.
Wow, that's brilliant. Thank you so much. I think people will be extremely interested to learn more of your work. Thank you for that. Paul, welcome to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about Fab Inc., the work you do, and please elaborate on how you and your team are utilizing AI in education?
Of course, and thank you for having me on the show today. So I'm Paul Afton. I'm the founder of Fab Inc. We're a small organization, and we work predominantly in low and middle income countries, where we generally try to help governments and delivery partners, so the people actually providing the support services, using data for improving their knowledge. And we've been working a lot in Sierra Leone for the last 6 years, and we have spent a lot of time improving their back-end data systems, including helping them with education planning. We did a bunch of work on predictive analytics, the old-fashioned AI, as I like to think, in Kenya and Nepal, and started thinking seriously about how do we, you know, integrate some of these more modern cutting-edge technologies into planning and program design. We got very excited, I should say, when the new wave of generative AI came out. One of the things we've been spending a lot of time working on is what we call Teacher AI, which is a WhatsApp-driven chatbot, which we've been implementing in Sierra Leone for the last 9 months now, and to some popularity amongst teachers. We were chatting a lot with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation because we realized this was just far bigger than Fab and something which we should do and work on collaboratively. So in October, we launched an initiative called AIforEducation.org. We're trying to work together with people to crowdsource some of the knowledge, tools, and open source code to help make sure that sub-Saharan Africa in particular doesn't get left behind in this new wave of innovation.
Wow, guys, I'm super happy that we have you here in the show. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm sure we will learn a lot. Let's move to another expert in this field. Let's go to Bob, my dear colleague. Now, Bob, there's a number of publications that have highlighted the promises of AI in education. From your perspective, what impact have you seen when AI is integrated into the classroom? And perhaps you can shed light on the role that AI could play in the near future for education.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for your generosity with the term expert. Oftentimes, I feel like I'm the one-eyed man in the land of the blind. But it's great to be here with Paul and Jamie and to continue on this learning journey. Our experience to date has been primarily around the early versions of AI and machine learning through adaptive learning software and the very positive impacts that we've seen in different countries with regard to use of the technology to bring students up to grade level and teaching at the right level. Also, I think Paul had mentioned some of the work that he had done around predictive analytics and some of the promising work on early warning systems to be able to identify students that are at risk. And I got really excited with this latest generation of AI. It's tough to believe it's not even been a little more over a year when Midjourney, Stable Diffusion, DALL-E came out. ChatGPT, I think, is just about a year old. And I think three areas that we've been most excited about are first around this idea of content creation. This was a discussion, Jamie, that we had at the M Education Alliance around some work you were doing around early grade reading and storytelling. And I think the discussion that came out of that meeting was more excitement around the possibilities to democratize content creation and the inevitability of the technology that it is here with us and it will continue to grow. So to kind of understand the impact, we've been working through a project called Evoke here at the World Bank. We brought together a number of very disadvantaged youth from across Colombia for what we call a creative hackathon to support teams to develop their own stories around the issue of climate change. And in fact, the winning team, the story that they developed, has actually been implemented now at a national tournament. And the amount of time and resources that it took for these youth to develop this story were significantly less than what had been previously developed as a content creation process involving graphic artists, curriculum designers, etc. Within the same project, the team has also been iterating around the idea of virtual tutors. And what the team did was fed the model with very specific content to get specific questions on how they should think about developing their own projects. And then finally, we've been experimenting with assessment around 21st century skills that have traditionally been assessed through self-report that is divorced really from the learning intervention itself. So looking at ways in which to define these skills and using the models to then assess the extent to which they are indeed developing communication or collaboration or creativity or empathy or problem solving. Has been extremely enlightening. And what we found is that it's saving time for the teachers to be able to analyze these results and engage on a more personalized level. So let me stop there on those three issues, democratization of digital content, virtual tutoring, and assessment, specifically for some of these hard-to-measure skills. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Bob. That's fantastic. And you proved to be an expert. That's absolutely the case. I mean, tutoring, adaptive assessment, content creation are many of the tracks that we can explore. But the three of you have highlighted the idea that this is not a closed-door innovation. It's, to some extent, a living lab that is reaching underserved communities, low-resource learning settings, or even displaced people. Now, we have just passed the first year of this technology. Let me pick up a little bit of your brain for those who might not be expert in this field. So it's not going to be an academic definition, but what are the elements that you think will be helpful for people to understand Gen AI in education? Jamie?
Sure. So generally speaking, generative artificial intelligence is just a system that's able to generate new content. So we have these computational models that have been trained up on large sets of existing content. Basically, you show them the entire internet, and you train them up in being able to generate new content that resembles the types of content that they've been trained on. And so that's everything from, you know, one that most folks are familiar with, like ChatGPT, where it's generating text, to systems like DALL-E and Midjourney and Stable Diffusion, where it's generating novel images. And now a lot of technology is being developed around generation of video, of 3D models, of music, and audio. And so essentially, it's being able to create novel content as well as have back and forth interactions like we see with ChatGPT, where it can start to engage in dialogue with us.
Yeah, and I think the clue's in the name to a certain extent. Like, generative AI is just AI that allows us to generate new content. And, you know, that could be text, that could be images. Images can become video, it can become sound, and whatever, really. Like, a lot of AI just tries to predict. So it gets really, really good at predicting the next letter, the correct pixel in a document. And when you scale this to the computing power we have now, it's just really, really good at predicting. So that allows us to just generate new content, be that a textbook, a little song to help children learn, or a little video to help them visualize something as well. So yeah, the clue's in the name a little bit, where you can just generate content.
So maybe just to add a little bit to these two definitions, I think it's really interesting in the sense that it uses unstructured data. And I think what we hear a lot about is this issue of hallucination, of the models getting it wrong. And I guess a question that it would be interesting to explore in this discussion is whether hallucination is a bug or a feature. And does hallucination create unexpected outputs, the creativity, the novelty. I do think this raises questions around how we work with developing countries to get more data, relevant contextualized data into these models. Right now, the vast majority of the data is coming from the US and Europe. And then the final issue that that I think Paul raised was around cost. What are the costs that developing countries need to think about, both as they use these models globally and as they begin to develop their own customized models?
That's super helpful. Who would like to follow? Maybe, Paul, you can add your perspective here.
I think you touched on a really good point there, Bob, which is this whole hallucination problem and whether or not we think it is a feature or bug, because yes, they hallucinate, as in they get it wrong, because, you know, they're not purely information retrieval kind of system. So somewhere on the internet, someone has written 2 + 2 = 5. These things predict based on the internet. So perhaps, you know, we need to append them with other things as well. Like, we have search engine technology, which is really good at retrieving specific bits of information. LLMs, actually, the creativity, is this a feature or a bug? I actually think it's a feature. And it's just one where when we come into the use cases, we need to be really cautious and design those knowing what we know about education and about how these LLM works. And that's why it's really key that we have the educationalists in with the technologists in all these discussions, so we can make sure that that's working. I think a bigger point here is actually that the training data is often coming out of Western countries, predominantly the US. It's stuff which is high frequency on the internet that might not be pedagogically sound. So it's not hallucination per se, it's just not what we want it. Like, learning styles with noise and outdated pedagogy. ChatGPT suggests it every time I use it. So I think we've just got to be cautious and design with what we know about these models in mind. Jamie, I can see you want to jump in as well.
Yeah, I think worth noting that one of the issues is that we're kind of overloading these models. We're building these quote-unquote thinking machines, but we're also expecting them to have memorized everything, all of the knowledge of the world, every single fact, into kind of the same structures. So I think one of the directions that that's going to head in the future is kind of separating out the knowledge bank from the thinking, reasoning, language engine, and then relying on actual, you know, agency the same way a human would to search and find the right content and get the right context and make sure it's backing up its answers in the kind of approaches we've talked about of retrieval augmented generation, where it's looking up information on the fly and incorporating that in to make sure that it's grounded in fact. Taking a step back, maybe we dig in a bit on generative AI for education. And I think one of the most common ways that people are concerned about is direct use by students, just one-to-one, a student engaging with something like ChatGPT for getting their questions answered, being guided through something, or drafting essays and text for various purposes, as well as different assessment use cases that we've hinted at as well. When we're talking about things like hallucination, the riskiest, not just from the kind of overt misinformation, but also, you know, you don't have this pedagogical mediation. And so I think it's worthwhile thinking about other use cases that aren't necessarily direct student one-to-one. Also, as Bob was talking about in terms of cost, there's a scaling question of how we fund direct one-to-one student usage in an equitable way globally. But if we think about use by teachers to support students indirectly, that could be things like lesson planning, developing custom materials, as Paul was talking about, providing feedback on classes, as well as supporting with streamlining tedious activities like grading. But taking one step further back out, I think there's a lot of exciting work to be done. And this is the area that we've been focusing on for things like organizing existing materials, as well as development of new materials in a central way that then can go through, you know, a vetting and review process before they go out. So there can be that extra set of filtering and human eyes on it, but really reducing the workload barriers to producing new content.
That's brilliant. Bob, anything to add?
Thanks. Our strategy paper is titled Reimagining Human Connections. So I think the human element is always critical in education. I think AI needs to be thought about in how we can augment our own humanity and replace maybe some of the routine tasks that will save us time to engage more with students. And I think this interesting question around hallucination and scraping something off of the web that says 2 + 2 = 5. And I think just a worry around the veracity of information on the web. At what point will there be more information created by AI than authentic information created by humans, and how we deal with this? I don't have an answer, but I'm just going to pose some of these questions as we begin to look at ways in which to kind of guide and inform policymakers and educators on how best to think about the use of this technology.
Wonderful. Thank you to all of you. I think you provide a very compelling understanding and that give us so much light in terms of navigating from the surprise of this emerging technology into understanding this big, big difference between having access to information and having the knowledge to select, use, and adapt relevant information, which is completely a different approach. Many of these things have been developed in environments where full connectivity is available. Is generative AI exclusively a solution only for affluent countries? Could you share inclusive initiatives or interventions where this technology can be adopted in educational contexts with limited digital infrastructure or connectivity? Maybe, Paul, can we start with you?
Yeah, of course. And I think a lot of this comes back to the use case. So a lot of people think initially about how do we get this so it completely just first of all helps the student or teacher in the classroom. There's a big bunch of use cases, which I actually think will be the first wave of use cases in low resource environments, which is the stuff Jamie's doing in terms of how do we use generative AI to co-pilot a lot of the back office stuff, where there will be connectivity and you don't need it instantly. So I think we need to look at the use cases and think, okay, what example are we optimizing for? So you need to think through, well, what can we conceivably do with 2G connections and a very dumb smartphone? The answer is a surprising amount because a lot of this stuff is run on the server side. So because of that, the key question is, can we afford cloud-based servers? And that's a far bigger question because the cost of inference, as they say, which is getting the LLM to do the calculations, to do the prediction and give you the text, is surprisingly high. Actually, Chris, you and I have discussed this before, but the climate cost, I think, is something to consider as we move towards mass use of these technologies. That's an aside, but something which very much worries me. So lots we can do, but yeah, there will be some barriers.
Yeah, exactly. I think connectivity, and that's a challenge that we at Learning Equality have been focused on for 10 years, is central, but as Paul is saying, you know, you can leverage lower bandwidth channels for a lot of these text-based interactions. And so it does open up new possibilities. So it's exciting seeing a lot of groups working with things like SMS and WhatsApp and other low bandwidth distribution channels to enable broader access. But fully agree, who's going to pay for the API credits or the cloud servers to run these large clusters of GPUs that are required in the cloud to do the really high functioning GPUs. I think a couple other key barriers. One is just the digital literacy, but also the specific AI competencies that are needed to effectively engage with these tools, both within the education environment, but of course, coming out of that into the workforce as well, with AI competency is going to be such a huge differentiator in hireability and workforce efficiency. And then the fourth, I think, is as Bob was mentioning earlier, the language diversity of these models. We know the importance of mother tongue learning, especially in early grades. And so we need to build out data sets with broader language diversity that can be used to train these systems. You know, at Learning Equality with our platform Calibri, it's offline first. So it can run in a classroom, in a home, on a device where there's no connectivity whatsoever. But we leverage occasional connectivity as well as peer-to-peer synchronization using database replication technologies we've developed. And we're exploring ways to leverage that asynchronous synchronization to do things like free text assessment, where students are submitting work into the offline platform. We bring large sets of content for use offline. There's a lot of potential for a completely offline retrieval augmented generation language model, but we're just not there yet. You know, we have a long way to go there, but I think there is potential with a lot of focus on pushing stuff to the edge and having models that can be run on low power devices and still do effective tasks.
Super, Jamie. Bob, something else to add?
I think Jamie and Paul covered it fairly well. I mean, I do think part of our obligation and challenge is to stay abreast of technological changes and to support countries to think ahead. And these cycles are getting shorter and shorter. So opportunities on using mobile devices, opportunities to localize data, opportunities for learning in local languages, kind of the impetus to ensure that there is a purpose and a direction and that there is critical thinking as well with regard to the type of information that's being provided and the dialogues that will invariably happen.
Super. Paul?
Cool, thank you. So we're actually seeing quite a lot of good ideas, less pilots than we expected, but people with some really sensible ideas for application. One is an initiative linked to what Jamie was saying with an organization called Beaky, who do essentially school in a box kind of work and trying to develop hardware to do learning management systems traditionally, but we just give a small grant to explore exactly this question of what a good offline first language model can look like. We're also thinking through some of the language and translation issues. There's an organization called BookBots who've been working mostly in Indonesia, exploring whether or not we can support them to test out the transfer of some of their technology. If they can get 100 children reading a little book on their device, and they can do the audio technology to make the voice recognition and use some of that kind of AI tech to be able to grade the children's scores. So there's a bunch of different initiatives going on as well in this space.
Brilliant. And thank you so much, because these ideas and the work in progress shed a lot of optimism and opportunities that I am sure we will learn more in the near future, and please keep us in the loop. Let me get back to our local expert, Bob. Our audience includes teachers, faculties, school principals, researchers, policymakers in education. What recommendation would you like to share with them? And also, what about parents? How should parents or educators approach this field? What would be your take here?
I think it's an exciting time for educators to become learners. And to really have an open mind and take an opportunity first to learn as much as possible about the technology and specifically how it is being used in different education systems. I think one of my fears is that educators continually stress the importance of thinking and to be wary that that these tools do not replace thought, and specifically critical thought, which will probably change some of the pedagogies that are currently seen in many classrooms around the world, which is mainly focused on dissemination of knowledge as opposed to interrogation of knowledge. I also think that there are opportunities to use these technologies to do and to create and to look at ways of how educators can empower themselves and students to think about this technology as an extension of the human, as a virtual tutor, a virtual assistant, to be able to assist with creative processes, with developing new projects in their communities. So I think it opens a large world of potential for different ways to use the technology in education and in, I think, reforming some of the curriculum in the way that the teaching is done. Invariably, I do, however, think that this technology will be mainly accessed outside of the classroom. So there is an important role for parents. And I think that parents need to be aware that the outputs are not always true, to be very aware of how to support students to think about using the technology, not to, again, replace thinking or the hard work of writing, for instance, but to augment what they do. I know many parents and students have banned this technology for schoolwork, and there needs to be kind of a moderated approach, because I do think that this technology will continue to grow and will continue to provide both challenges and incredible benefits.
Brilliant, brilliant. A huge call to learn, experiment in and outside of the classroom, and also develop some level of awareness and quality selection of information. That's super helpful. And let me address the three of you with our closing question, which I think is related to that. Jamie also mentioned it at some point, and Paul, the idea of developing some level of fluency. Should education systems consider redefining their curriculums to incorporate AI into the programs? What is your position on how education systems should address this idea of an AI literacy or AI fluency? What would be your view here? Let's start with Paul.
I think it's going to be super important. We've thought about it a lot in terms of teacher level skills here, because one of the things we realized very early on with the chatbot, and I'm sure people will know this, the better the prompts you give to language models, the better the answer. So when we were looking at the teachers' prompts and usage, we realized that the ones that were using it a lot were getting better at asking the questions and structuring the questions and being really clear what they want. So for teachers, a lot of work needs to be done in terms of training them how to use these language models. How do you ask the questions? How do you ask the prompt? And so on and so forth. And this is something we're going to be exploring over the coming months with teachers. For children, I think it's definitely going to be important. We often talk about using AI for good, but you can create content that might be harmful as well. So how do we train students to recognize, you know, fake news and other kind of more worrying uses for content, I think will be an important kind of stream of work over the coming years, but not something I've engaged much with, I'll be honest.
Something Bob said earlier really resonated around helping students understand how to use the technology to do and create, rather than have it just replicating traditional content distribution, chalk and talk, teacher-centered activities, but really thinking about how we can use this as an additional tool to foster student-centered learning. And one thing that we've been really focusing on as an organization is supporting project-based learning and learning through doing and creating, so that you can use them as an additional tool, you know, design something effective and really get their hands on and practice. So I think that's a way to both foster more project-based learning, but also to get hands-on using these technologies, because it's not that we need abstract knowledge about what these systems are. We need to know how to use them effectively to make our lives better and to do things we want to do. So I think directly incorporating into things like PBL would be really important. One framework I know that's being developed and has had a lot of different stakeholder input is UNESCO's AI competency framework for students and teachers. And so I think feeding into those types of frameworks that can be incorporated, but rather than thinking of them as something separate, thinking about what aspects of the existing curriculum can these tools directly support and enrich. And I think something like project-based learning would be a really powerful place for that.
And maybe just to complement those thoughts, I do think that education systems will have to grapple more with discussions around truth, facts, opinions. We'll have to look at ethics. We'll have to focus on critical thinking and questioning kind of what is presented. I do think that hard work will never be replaced, that kind of effort and struggle to learn and to discover truth and knowledge must continue to be emphasized. This isn't kind of an easy way out. I do agree, again, on the importance of using these technologies to do and create. And the final thought is to not hide behind the technologies, but to get out and engage in the world, to engage in face-to-face conversations with people of different opinions, and to connect and learn.
Brilliant. Well, this has been a fantastic discussion. I want to share that we are recording this in the winter, but might not be the winter of AI and might be the summer in other parts of the world. But based on the voice of our guest today, this is overall not winter or summer, it's a learning season. It's time for experimentation, for exploration, for creation, for learning, for trying, for guiding, for asking questions, difficult questions to the world of education. Thank you so much to all of you for your time, your thoughtful advice. We will share some of the information of your organizations in the description of the podcast and hope to see you very soon in a near podcast. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much for having us. Great conversation, everyone.
Thanks all. Speak soon.